on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 87-year-old Jack Venables of Merced, California. At the tender age of 16, he saw his first combat on Guadalcanal with the 2nd Marine Division in World War II. He was telling us a little bit about that before we stepped away, so we'll jump back into it now. You mentioned working with a unit manning 75-millimeter PAC howitzers, and there's a photo of your crew in action in the official 2nd Marine Division history book. I have that photo up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. How many men did it take to operate those guns, and what kind of duties did you have?
At the time, I was a battery recorder on Guadalcanal, and I would take the orders during the night, usually, because we'd fire early in the morning. I would then pass the coordinates down to the gunners, and they would set their gun sights. They had two aiming stakes, and you had to line up your sights on the aiming stake so that you could only see one. Then they could go ahead and fire. But I wasn't a gunner at that time. I was later.
What was the range on these guns?
A little over 5 miles.
So you had no idea whether you're actually hitting something until someone relays that back to you?
Not usually. We had a forward observer that would relay it back. But on this particular battle, when we were above Cape Esperance, of course, we could see what was happening.
Because you were so high up.
Exactly, yeah.
The rest of the time, did that end up being a blessing that you couldn't see where those shells were going and how much damage they were doing?
On the canal, my brother was telling me that they had captured a Japanese, and he wanted to know where the automatic artillery was. We were firing 30 rounds a minute.
Wow.
When we were in training in the States, they had a lanyard, which is the thing that pulls the trigger, whatever you want to call it, on a gun. And we were 30 feet behind the gun in a sandbag, and the lanyard was that long. And then they'd tell us to fire, and we'd pull the lanyard, or one guy would. When we were in battle, that lanyard was about less than 2 feet long, and the guy would stand there right next to it. And we'd throw the ammunition into the breech. When in the States, you just gently put it in there.
Right.
But we couldn't fire fast enough doing it that way. Had that blown up, they would have lost quite a few of us crew members.
Sure.
We didn't have fixed ammunition. You have a shell casing, then you have the head of the ammo, and you set the timing on the head, and you use silk powder bags put in the shell casing. So each of those determines when the one on the head determines how soon it will explode, and of course the number of powder bags determines how the distance you get out of it. So it took two guys to do that. One guy at the rear of the gun to move the gun one way or the other. We had about 8 or 9 of us.
So you got your first action with one of those 75-millimeter PAC howitzer crews at Guadalcanal, and you got there at almost the midway point of a battle that raged on for 6 months. I don't know if everyone realizes that. A 6-month battle that claimed over 38,000 lives if you combine both sides. The Allies lost over 7,000 men. They lost 615 aircraft. Those are pretty staggering numbers. But the next battle for you was even bloodier. Over 1,000 Marines were killed and more than 2,000 wounded in a battle that only lasted 4 days. The battle in November 1943 for the tiny Tarawa Atoll in the Gilbert Islands. Regular listeners of Hometown Heroes may remember hearing about the main landing force there at Tarawa getting caught up on coral reefs and then having to wade through the surf at a heavy, heavy cost because of enemy fire. But you didn't come in there. You came in on the backside with your 75-millimeter group?
We are at the island right next to the main island of Tarawa. Now, that was a toll. Gilbert Islands is what they were called. And so Tarawa was the main thrust of the battle, and that's where they were dug in so well, it's unbelievable. They had built bunkers, and they were difficult. The only way we were able to get them out was with a flamethrower, for the most part, or throwing hand grenades in there.
And your brother was part of that main landing force?
I thought he was, but he had transferred. He had been in the 8th Marines when we were in New Zealand. And the 8th Marines took a real beating landing. They had a high casualty rate. But it turned out my brother had transferred into the 6th Marines, and he wasn't sent into the island until after it was secured, and they were on a team of mop-up going down the atoll. Another friend of mine and I went looking for him, and when the tide's out, you can walk between the islands, which we were doing. We had our rifles and well prepared in case we ran into some Japanese. But we would ask about the 6th Marines as we'd see different people. Have you seen them? Yeah, they just passed not long ago. And so we kept going and going, and it was hot as heck. And finally, the tide started coming in, and my buddy said, well, we got to go back, and we're not going to find him. And so we did. We started going back. No, the tide was coming in, and so pretty soon it's up to our ankles and then up to our knees. By the time we got to the island right next to Tarawa, almost, well, it was at our chest height, and we had our rifles held above our heads trying to get back to the island, and Amtrak came by with a bunch of other Marines in it. And they laughing like heck. I should say laughing like hell. That's what they were doing. And they plucked us out of the water and took us back to the main island.
And so you found out your brother wasn't around those parts anyway, so it was a good thing you got bailed out at that point. And I know when you're in the middle of something, it's probably hard to grasp the magnitude of it. But in the years since, when you have read about that battle and you see the number of casualties, and you realize how bad it was for so many, has that added to your perspective of what you were a part of there, how significant that chapter of the World War II history was?
It's interesting because before we landed, we were still aboard ship and they were bringing back casualties, all shot up. And I'll tell you, that isn't spooky. Knowing that we're going to go in, fortunately we didn't land on the main island, but there were bodies floating on the water by the time we got in. So it was terrible, really sickening.
Did you ever get used to that? Did you get desensitized, or was it always really difficult to stomach?
Always difficult to stomach. We were moving up, and an Army MP told us to pull over to the side of the road, and we had guys sitting on the back of the truck. It was a 10-wheel truck, and guys sitting on the top and the front and so on. Fortunately, I wasn't sitting on the back because the little gun, the truck straddled a landmine, but the gun didn't, and it blew up. And it caught shrapnel, hit these guys riding in the back of the truck.
Well, I imagine that gets your attention and reminds you of how perilous your own future might be.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, so many people, they think about the Marines in World War II, and maybe they've seen that iconic image from Iwo Jima atop Mount Suribachi, or they know the magnitude of the battle at Okinawa, and they forget about some of these battles that we're talking about, the early days at Guadalcanal, the bloody battle at Tarawa that we just discussed, and maybe two that are really overlooked are Saipan and Tinian, and they happen so close together, and they often get overshadowed, I think, by those more famous battles. And when you got to Saipan, there's a part of the island where just inland is a big airstrip, and obviously that had some strategic value for the American Marines landing there. Is that where you came aboard that island?
We crossed the airstrip. They had we dumped us off near the beach. We, of course, weren't in the initial assault, being in the artillery. But, yeah, they had Japanese firing at us as we ran across the airstrip. And then when we did get our guns all lined up and set up, we were getting shelled, and they had the trees right above our guns, or right next to our guns, I should say, and the trees were quite tall, and the shells would hit the trees, and, of course, shrapnel would fly all over that place. And we had, after we'd been there, while we had dug a large, very large foxhole, and we'd put timber across the top of it. Anyway, it would handle our gun crew, so it was pretty big. And I was on the phone when we were being shelled very badly, and everybody dove into the foxhole, and I was the last to get in there. I yelled to the guys, I'm blind, I can't see, because the shell had burst just before I got into the hole, and I'd gotten the blast that hit my eyes. I didn't get hit with any shrapnel or anything. But anyway, I told the guys I couldn't see, and the guy said, well, open your eyes. And I did, and I could see.
Those few seconds, I'm sure, felt like a week or two to you, huh?
Yeah, it did. There's one thing about Saipan. That when we were coming to Saipan, they announced the invasion in Europe. It was June the 6th, and we thought, big deal. Here we are, it's June 15th. And we're going into battle. And nobody's talking about our battles. So yeah. We're kind of jealous until we found out later what a big deal it was in Europe. But we were kind of disappointed they didn't publicize our landings. In that landing, when I came ashore, there were a bunch of Marine bodies lying on the shore. And one of them looked from the rear. His face was down in the sand, and it looked like my brother, because he had a Japanese airplane band on his watch, and so did this guy. And I turned him over, and it wasn't my brother. And boy, was that a big relief, because he'd already gone in. And we got together on Saipan, He came back from the front, and he had brought a bottle of sake back with him. And they were all drinking the sake. And I told Jim later, I said, that wasn't fair. I hardly got any. You guys had almost drunk it up by the time I got there.
Back home, neither one of you would have been old enough to drink.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. What I do recall was a last thrust of the Japanese military, and they hit our gun pits. We were behind this other battery of guns, and they were sticking their tank guns right into the gun pits and blasting away at our crew members. And one of the guys raced back to our battery and was telling us about it. And boy, his face was white as a sheet because he'd gotten out of the gun emplacement, and some of the guys didn't. So, and of course, we didn't know if they were going to come make it through there. Line of battle or not.
And I'm sure you had countless that could have been me moments, but if ever there were one, there aren't too many of you gun crews out there, and that if the tanks are coming right at them and blowing them from here to Timbuktu, that had to take your breath away a little bit to even think of that prospect, huh?
Yeah, it did. And you know, it was strange too, because we can fire the 75 PAC-HAWS. There's direct fire, and apparently they didn't have time, or they didn't think about it. I don't know. Because they could have blown those tanks up because they weren't that well built.
And so people listening understand, when you say direct fire, normally these guns are going to be aimed at an arc to lob that shell a long distance. But you could have adjusted them, pointed them right at a target, and adjust the timing on the shells so they could have taken out a tank?
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As you go from battle to battle, and now Saipan, you've already been through Guadalcanal and Tarawa. Did you feel better prepared or more seasoned? Were you getting more confident or less confident? Because some guys say, well, hey, if they haven't got me yet, they're never going to. And some guys say, hey, it's only a matter of time. Where were you on that spectrum?
Well, scared. When they first started shelling us on Saipan, we weren't under the trees at the time. I was a gunner at the time, and I grabbed the gun sights, and the whole battery took off for the beach. We ended up in a 16-inch pit where the shell had hit, and it blew all the sand out of it. And the guys were lying that night, sleeping in that gun hole. And we could hear the firing. They were still fighting the Japanese during the night. And every once in a while, one of the spent bullets would hit the sand between one of us. And I couldn't believe it when I look back on it. No, not one of us got hit.
And I don't want to gloss over anything or miss anything on Saipan, but you didn't have far to go from there to get to Tinian. And folks say, well, what good are all these little tiny islands in the Pacific? And Tinian obviously has a great strategic importance when we look back on history. That's where the Enola Gay took off and dropped the atomic bomb. Did you guys have any inkling at the time that this little island you were going to was going to hold some significance?
No, I had no idea at all. That was the first time I'd seen a B-29, but that was the largest plane I think I'd ever seen. It was just enormous. And, of course, we were concerned about guarding it, too, because the island hadn't been completely secured when they got plane there.
The Battle of Tinian ended at the start of August 1944, and a year later, a B-29 dubbed Enola Gay, of course, made history when it took off from a runway the Venables brothers and all those Marines had fought to put into Allied hands. Colonel Paul Tibbetts and the Enola Gay crew dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and that would be the first blow in the hastening of an end to the war in the Pacific, the surrender of the Japanese, and the avoidance of even more extreme casualties than all those countries involved had already endured. Where was Jack when all that was happening? And we'll also find out what other challenges he had to face besides those determined Japanese forces. Disease was a major problem for troops in the Pacific, and Jack's going to tell us what malaria feels like from firsthand experience. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
EECU reminds us of the importance of honoring our greatest generation.
Hi, I'm Paul Leffler, and there's nothing I enjoy more than honoring our hometown heroes from the greatest generation. That's why I'm so excited that Honor Flight, a nonprofit organization that flies World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., is closing in on a very successful first year. And if that wasn't exciting enough, I'm thrilled to tell you that my friends at EECU are once again raising money to help the next round of vets make that journey.
Hurry in to EECU during the month of March to get financing as low as 2.2% APR on new and used autos. And EECU will donate $50 to Central Valley Honor Flight for every qualifying auto loan over $10,000.
In World War II, all gave some and some gave all. Let's come together and help give our veterans one more tour. with honor.
EECU, smarter banking since 1934.
Rates subject to change. Some restrictions apply. Federally insured by NCUA.